Stevens. I'm used to speaking with a microphone. Can you hear me? All right. Just wave your hand if I need to speak up. As I have said many times, we're here really to do a little reminiscing. And that reminds me of a cartoon that I saw recently. An elderly couple sitting in their rocking chairs, and he said to his wife, "I so look forward to when I got older to reminiscing." And he said, "Now I'm older and I can't remember a dang thing." Back in 1929, when I was teaching at the University of Minnesota, the president, Charles Bunnell, of the Agricultural College and School of Mines, came to interview teachers. I had not even heard of that college, and I had not applied, but my dean said, "Wouldn't you like to see him?" Well, he came from Washington, D.C., as I said, on legislation. He offered me the position as professor and head of home economics. It was intriguing, but I told him I could not stay but 1 year, and it wouldn't be fair to him. But he said, "Oh, well, that's all right. If you didn't want to stay the second year, we wouldn't want you." He knew his psychology. And most of you know about the people who come for 1 year. So he left without any commitment on my part to attend the legislature in Juneau. There, of course, he met with the usual opposition. One legislator said he would never contribute anything to that campus anything for Dr. Bunnell's $50,000 woodshed, he called it. That was the only building on the campus. Now, it was a land-grant college, and the federal government provided $50,000 with the land-grant. So he called it Dr. Bunnell's $50,000 woodshed. Those were the days when they turned back the clock to extend the legislature, so he was there quite a while. And about 2 weeks later, I had a wire from him, from Fairbanks, with a contract asking me to sign. It was a salary of about $3,000. And he asked me to bring along another teacher. And I hired my office mate, Aline Sewell. Now, those were the days of no job advertising, no selection committee, no affirmative action, no tenure, no married women, and married women were not paid as men were. It was a big decision, of course. I was very happy in my position, but I like challenges, and this certainly was a challenge, and then besides, a change might be very good. And that reminds me of the story of the Catholic priest who was so depressed. The confessions were very disturbing, the finances were in trouble, and there were many other problems. So he consulted his psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, "Well, just what you need is a change. Take off that clerical collar, put on some old clothes, and go out on the town." He did just that, and at the first stop, he met the cutest little cocktail waitress. And she said, "What do you have, Father Flanagan?" And he said, "How did you know I was Father Flanagan?" And she said, "Well, I'm Sister Teresa, and I have the same psychiatrist that you have." Well, that 1 year extended through 29 years at the university. I had to borrow the money for the trip, which took 2 weeks, from my home in southern Illinois by train to Minneapolis, Pullman to Seattle, and Alaska steamship to Seward, stopping in every port. The two-day train trip from Seward included an overstop at Curry. We arrived August 24, 1929, and that was 55 years ago. at the College Station at the foot of the hill on the railroad track, the dormitory hostess boarded the train to accompany us to the Nordale Hotel and the Model Cafe for dinner and as guests of Dr. Bunnell in absentia. Later he came to the hotel to greet us, and since he did not drive, his student chauffeur picked us up the next morning for orientation at the college. After that, we took the Brill car on the railroad and walked up the hill from the College Station to the old main building. The friendly conductor watched to see if we were arriving on time, and if he saw us just crossing the Christmas Street Bridge, he would stop, back up, and wait. And that was typical of the casual way of life in those days. Transportation by Paul and Flora Griman's bus came much later on the dirt road with one-way traffic through the peat bog. There were only three houses en route. As sometimes faculty and students walked the track 3 miles to save money. A 22 rifle was handy to bring home a grouse or a rabbit for dinner. Since there were no since there was no campus housing, we lived at the Nordale Hotel on 2nd Avenue. Single rooms with hall bath at $45 per month, and ate a la carte at the Model Cafe, and that was just across the street. And the only way to get a balanced meal within a reason was to share with another, which we often did. Bernie Carr, Pete Despo, and Lil Angerman were very helpful. Food prices were high. There were no weekend specials, nothing by air, so the eggs were sometimes a little high. Later, we had three kinds of eggs, ranch, boat, and airborne, priced accordingly. The butcher shop cut frozen whole carcasses by the electric saw while the customer waited. Frozen chickens were shipped in, dressed, but not drawn, with the head and feet on. We learned to use evaporated and dried milk and dried eggs. There were no pennies until the Piggly Wiggly came in much later. I went into Bradley's shoe stop one day to buy a pair of shoelaces. He threw down two pair, and I said I just wanted one pair, but he said you might just as well take them. The price of two bits would be just the same. There were no nickels and dimes. Hal Bailey of Lailery and Bailey's grocery store on 2nd and Cushman liked to fool the tourists. He had a great sense of humor, and the tourists were always complaining. When a local customer in cahoots asked for a dollar's worth of grapes, he very carefully cut off one grape, put it in a sack, and took the dollar. Of course, it was a silver dollar, since we had no paper money at that time. Since there were no florists in town, instead of corsages, men set baskets of fruit to women friends. Martin Pinska of Pinsker's store, an eligible bachelor, always bought cakes at the church bazaars and had them sent to the hotel for the teachers. Among those teachers were Annabeth Rennie Hanlon, Sylvia Edarth Pratt, Laura Lee Carr, and Mary Benjamin Adler. Ann Robinson Ween and Beth Green Walkwitz rented Mrs. Hess's log cabin, which was, of course, without plumbing or water. You know, Mrs. Hess, later on a member of the Board of Regents, was the one who selected the site for the college by tying her handkerchief on a bush on the top of the hill. She loved to tell about the tourists who passed her house on Cushman Street, and they peered in and said, why, they even have carpets on the floor. These same tourists wrap their legs with newspapers or toilet paper as a deterrent to mosquitoes. No spraying of mosquitoes in town at that time. There were four churches, the Episcopal, the Catholic, Christian Science, and the Presbyterian. And that's the one that is now at Alaska Land. I taught a Sunday school class in that building there on 7th and Cushman. There were no paved streets, no city water, no sewer system, no radio, no TV, very few cars, only one or two blacks, no Eskimos, only one bank, that's the First National, and no dial phones. You just gave the name to the operator, who might say, well, dear, you know, this is Mrs. Hess's bridge day. Shall I call her at Mrs. Clark's? Telephone service at time, bless their hearts, Mrs. Herring, Mrs. Brandt, Edna Lawson, and others. Mrs. Weir was one. The Empress Theater on 2nd Avenue showed black and white silent films. I remember the first sound film. It was Al Jolson. Don Adler was the very fine organist at the theater. In addition to the church programs, there was no end to community activities. Ice skating was under the Cushman Street Bridge, where the dog races started at that time, and the carved ice palace was erected there for the ice carnival. The ski trail and the warm-up hut both were where the cemetery is now. There was no military base at that time. The Newsminer published the passenger list of the weekly train. It was customary to meet arrival and departure trains. It was a social thing of the week. Eva McGowan with her Cheerio was always there. My work at the college involved long hours, a heavy schedule, no private office, no secretary, no budget, no phone, but classes were small, sometimes on a one-to-one basis, with a chance to adapt courses to the individual needs of students. Money was on the dole system. We had to present the need and verify it. There was one electric stove, one Hobart mixer, all, of course, on DC current. And no electric refrigerator or freezer. The great outdoors, the fire escape and window boxes substituted. Dr. Bunnell had a garden on the hill in front of the old main building. And when I said I needed vegetables for my class, he did not reply, but when I came back from lunch that day, the vegetables were in the lab. Can you feature the college president digging and delivering the vegetables? But he was like that, very supportive of home economics, interested in research. He obtained enough canned salmon for my classes to experiment with and develop original recipes, which were published in an attractive bulletin entitled Canned Salmon Delicacies. He even wrote the foreword. We worked up specific recipes and published a bulletin on sourdough. We developed recipes for local lowbush cranberries, which were published in a New York newspaper at that time. Bird's Eye frozen foods were not yet on the market, but we did some original work on freezing food. Local potatoes were not fully accepted because they were said to be too sweet. With some chemical tests for sugar and starch, we found with proper storage, local potatoes became more acceptable. Another challenge was the opportunity to work with Otto Geist, archaeologists, who brought back Eskimo artifacts from diggings on St. Lawrence Island. I wrote four articles on Eskimo food habits, clothing, shelter, and children's toys, which Dr. Monell hand-carried to Washington, D.C. to be published in a series in the National Journal of Home Economics. And these are now in the archives at the university. The university offered short courses in order to serve townspeople and increase the enrollment. The miners' short course brought in prospectors and miners during the freeze-up to live in the dormitories and register in various courses. One man chose not to live in the dormitory, but to live in a shack above the hill. The popular cook, Ann Luke, saved the leftovers in number 10 cans, which she just put outdoors to freeze until he could pick them up. He stacked the frozen blocks of food on stumps and boxes outside his cabin door. When he decided on his menu, he just hacked off a portion of each frozen pile. You could observe a cross-section of baked beans, spaghetti and meatballs, sauerkraut and weenies, stew or mashed potatoes and gravy. And there'd be stacks of sourdough hotcakes and biscuits. That was very handy. No shopping and no looking for specials at the supermarket. One popular course was my camp cookery course. Early on, one burly old prospector asked me how to make biscuits out in the bush with no utensils. I explained how to roll down the sides of the flour sack, make a well, add the baking powder, salt, fat, and dry milk, add water, mix well with a clean stick, and bake until there was a soft dough, and bake on a stick or on an improvised reflector. He sat on the edge of his chair, listening and nodding, and I thought how wonderful to have students who are so interested in their work. But when I finished, he said, "That's right, I just wanted to find out if you knew." Little did he know that that was old hat to me, for I had been teaching camp cookery to the forestry students at the University of Minnesota. But he had to test the young professor. I was accepted, and after that could do no wrong. Of course, there was a credit course in camp cookery with Tim Twitchell, who got a job as cook with the Road Commission that paid for his entire 4 years at college. There was Allie Murphy, who held responsible jobs on the Dew Line, and Jack Maybe, the famous sourdough Jack of San Francisco now, who sent me an autographed copy of his book, Sourdough Recipes. He didn't say that he learned in my class, but I was glad to get the autographed copy. And there was also Leo Mark Anthony, who used it teaching the university mining short courses after graduation. Recently, I had a letter from a student that I haven't seen for over 50 years, and with your permission, I would like to quote from this recent letter. And he says, quote, "Back in 1932, there were three young men students at the college batching in a cabin at the foot of a hill belonging to Professor Gasser. Someone suggested we enroll in your camp cookery. I'll never forget how you taught us," quotes, "the making of baking powder biscuit, the cooking of green vegetables, cabbage, and so forth, making pies with dried apples, making gravy, and so forth." And so in planning for Thanksgiving, Ken McClarty had set out for a 10-pound frozen turkey, which we took to your lab. And you showed us how to make the dressing, stuff and truss the bird. So we took it down to the cabin and put it in the oven to roast. It was a Thanksgiving I'll never forget. Ken and his brother, Herb, had invited two old sourdoughs living nearby to have dinner with us. I like that, the sharing. The night before, Ken had made three dried apple pies. We made 2 quarts of ice cream, freezer, courtesy of the foods lab. I let them have it. We flavored it with cranberry juice, wild cranberry juice. We had mashed local potatoes with local cabbage, cooked quickly according to your directions to preserve the green color. We had cranberry jam with those good baking powder biscuits that I made. It was one heck of a memorable Thanksgiving Day dinner that lasted all afternoon. And that letter is from Jerry Knox of Olympia. And that's the quotation. But that's one of the friend's benefits of teaching, any kind of teaching, the appreciation of former students. It was an informal campus with an exceptionally well-qualified faculty offering degree programs that were accepted for transfer any place, fully accredited. It became the University of Alaska in 1935. Dr. Bunnell was a man of vision. His standards were high and he was a hard taskmaster. No student could drop out because of finances. He always could create a job or arrange a loan, often using his own money. He was keen and perceptive. One time, someone was turning off the lights on the trail from the college station to Old Main. He suspected 6-year-old young Ernest Patty Jr. He merely said, "What time did you turn off those lights, Ernest, last night?" Ernest very quickly said, "Oh, about 6 o'clock," before he realized the trap. And also, Dr. Bunnell, during the summer, put on old clothes and sneakers and showed tourists around the building. And of course, there was only one building to show. They thought he was the caretaker, and he accepted the dollar tips with glee. He kept the college open in spite of the budget cuts in the early 30s. We took voluntary cuts in salary. Miss Sewell took the semester off while I doubled up and took her courses. And I also taught at the University of Minnesota in summer school to supplement my income. My first trip outside was by train to Nenana, by riverboat to Tanana, and up the Yukon to Dawson. We pushed a barge full of freight and many dogs, stopping at all the villages and getting acquainted with everyone along the way. At Dawson, we exchanged sternwheelers to go to Whitehorse, where we took the narrow gauge train to the Skagway, then a Canadian steamship to Vancouver and Victoria. But on the return trip in the fall, I disembarked from the steamship at Valdez and took the stage along the Valdez Trail. The stage was a 7-passenger Cadillac with no other passenger. We had an overnight stop at Copper Center. In the meantime, my father was so intrigued with my hunting experience that he had ordered a .22 rifle just for me. It was still in the package, hand carried on the trip, but the driver assembled it and spotted the grouse and stopped for me to get out and aim. I arrived in Fairbanks with enough grouse to share with friends. In 1937, on commencement night, I was married to Gray Tilley at the Presbyterian Church at 7th and Cushman. He served in the Navy in World War I. Later, he was an engineering student at Washington State University. But in 1923, he took, quotes, a weekend cruise to southeastern Alaska, expecting to return to Seattle. But it turned out to be a long weekend. He worked as purser on the old Elizabeth Mail Boat out of Ketchikan, worked in the Juneau Treadmill Gold Mine, mined in the Chestachina area until gold pay dirt ran out, and the food supply was down to beans and blueberries without sugar on sourdough hotcakes. Eventually, he arrived in Fairbanks, traveling 4 days, four days by dog team. We built our own home on Tellum Street, much to the amazement of all who expected to retire outside. Then came the war, and Gray thought he had to fight a second world war. Dr. Monell called me immediately, and I went out to work the same day. He created a job for me in the Extension Service that included 4-H clubs, farmer military food market, radio program, newspaper column, writing bulletins, and giving demonstrations. The military took over the campus with a hospital in the girls' dorm, barracks and mess hall in the old main. We were moved from the top floor to the basement, and I went back to my old job as professor and head of home economics until I retired at age 65 in 1963. That's when I started substituting in the public schools in Fairbanks, not only because it was a challenge and I liked students, but it was an economic necessity. Teacher retirement started at $100 a month in those days. The university would have been closed permanently if it had not been for Dr. Bunnell. After the military left the campus, we moved back to the third floor with expanded, renovated quarters in the old main building until funds became available to finish the Eielson building. Since we were on the blueprints, we eventually moved into the third floor of Eielson with new modern equipment in about 1950. We added the nursery school teaching lab on the same floor. Then we set up the home management lab. No funds were available for new construction, so the old president's residence was moved and remodeled. It now stands in the vicinity of the fire station, and it's known as the Bunnell House, and it's only one of the original buildings left. I was fortunate to serve under the first four presidents, Bunnell, Moore, Patty, and Wood. Of course, Dr. Wood says I came with the land grant. And it has been exciting to be part of history in the making, and it's still exciting. Little did I know in 1929 that I would be making history and talking about history. And I'm still excited about 55 years in Alaska through 25 years of statehood. But let's not live in the past. Thank you very much.